Chapter 56. "I don't like leaving without Cyrus," said Oxley as he scanned the desert sky to the southwest. "Our brother has been in tougher scrapes before," said Zolar impassively. "A few Indians from a local village shouldn't present much of a threat to Amaru's hired killers." "I expected him long before now." "Not to worry. Cyrus will probably show up in Morocco with a girl on each arm." They stood on the end of a narrow asphalt airstrip that had been grooved between the countless dunes of the Altar Desert so Mexican Air Force pilots could hold training exercises under primitive conditions. Behind them, with its tail section jutting over the edge of the sand-swept strip, a Boeing 747-400 jetliner, painted in the colors of a large national air carrier, sat poised for takeoff. Zolar moved under the shade of the starboard wing and checked off the artifacts inventoried by Henry and Mickey Moore as the Mexican Army engineers loaded the final piece on board the aircraft. He nodded at the golden sculpture of a monkey that was being hoisted by a large forklift into the cargo hatch nearly 7 meters, 23 feet, from the ground. "That's the last of it." Oxley stared at the barrenness surrounding the airstrip. "You couldn't have picked a more isolated spot to transship the treasure." "We can thank the late Colonel Campos for suggesting it." "Any problem with Campos's men since his untimely death?" Oxley asked with more cynicism than sense of loss. Zolar laughed. "Certainly not after I gave each of them a 100-ounce bar of gold." "You were generous." "Hard not to be with so much wealth sitting around." "A pity Matos will miss spending his share," said Oxley. "Yes, I cried all the way from Cerro El Capirote." Zolar's pilot approached and gave an informal salute. "My crew and I are ready when you are, gentlemen. We would like to take off before it's dark." "Is the cargo fastened down securely?" asked Zolar. The pilot nodded. "Not the neatest job I've seen, but considering we're not using cargo containers, it should hold until we land at Nador in Morocco, providing we don't hit extreme turbulence." "Do you expect any?" "No, sir. The weather pattern indicates calm skies all the way." "Good. We can enjoy a smooth flight," said Zolar, pleased. "Remember, at no time are we to cross over the border into the United States." "I've laid a course that takes us safely south of Laredo and Brownsville into the Gulf of Mexico below Key West, before heading out over the Atlantic." "How soon before we touch down in Morocco?" Oxley asked the pilot. "Our flight plan calls for 10 hours and 55 minutes. Loaded to the maximum and then some, with several hundred extra pounds of cargo and a full fuel load, plus the detour south of Texas and Florida, we've added slightly over an hour to our flight time, which I hope to pick up with a tailwind." Zolar looked at the last rays of the sun. "With time changes, that should put us in Nador during early afternoon tomorrow." The pilot nodded. "As soon as you are seated aboard, we will get in the air." He returned to the aircraft and climbed a boarding ladder propped against the forward entry door. Zolar gestured toward the ladder. "Unless you've taken a fancy to this sand pit, I see no reason to stand around here any longer." Oxley bowed jovially. "After you." As they passed through the entry door, he paused and took one last look to the southwest. "I still don't feel right not waiting." "If our positions were reversed, Cyrus wouldn't hesitate to depart. Too much is at stake to delay any longer. Our brother is a survivor. Stop worrying." They gave a wave to the Mexican Army engineers who stood back from the plane and cheered their benefactors. Then the flight engineer closed and secured the door. A few minutes later, the turbines screamed and the big 747-400 rose above the rolling sand dunes, dipped its starboard wing, and banked slightly south of east. Zolar and Oxley sat in a small passenger compartment on the upper deck, just behind the cockpit. "I wonder what happened to the Moors," mused Oxley, peering through a window at the Sea of Cortez as it receded in the distance. "The last I saw of them was in the cavern as the last of the treasure was being loaded on a sled." "I'll wager Cyrus handled that little problem in concert with Congresswoman Smith and Rudy Gunn," said Zolar, relaxing for the first time in days. He looked up and smiled at his personal serving lady as she offered two glasses of wine on a tray. "I know it sounds strange, but I had an uneasy feeling they wouldn't be easy to get rid of." "I have to tell you, the same thing crossed Cyrus's mind, too. In fact, he thought they were a pair of killers." Oxley turned to him. "The wife, too? You're joking." "No, I do believe he was serious." Zolar took a sip of the wine and made an expression of approval and nodded. "Excellent. A California Cabernet from Chateau Montelena. You must try it." Oxley took the glass and stared at it. "I won't feel like celebrating until the treasure is safely stored in Morocco and we learn that Cyrus has left Mexico." Shortly after the aircraft had reached what the brothers believed was cruising altitude, they released their seat belts and stepped into the cargo bay, where they began closely examining the incredible golden collection of antiquities. Hardly an hour had passed when Zolar stiffened and looked at his brother queerly. "Does it feel to you like we're descending?" Oxley was admiring a golden butterfly that was attached to a golden flower. "I don't feel anything." Zolar was not satisfied. He leaned down and stared through a window at the ground less than 1,000 meters, less than 3,300 feet below. "We're too low," he said sharply. "Something is wrong." Oxley's eyes narrowed. He looked through an adjoining window. "You're right. The flaps are down. It looks like we're coming in for a landing. The pilot must have an emergency." "Why didn't he alert us?" At that moment, they heard the landing gear drop. The ground was rising to meet them faster now. They flashed past houses and railroad tracks, and then the aircraft was over the end of the runway. The wheels thumped onto concrete, and the engines howled in reverse thrust. The pilot stood on the brakes and soon eased off on the throttles as he turned the huge craft onto a taxiway. A sign on the terminal read, "Welcome to El Paso." Oxley stared speechless as Zolar blurted, "My God, we've come down in the United States!" He ran forward and began beating frantically on the cockpit door. There was no reply until the huge plane came to a halt outside an Air National Guard hangar at the opposite end of the field. Only then did the cockpit door slowly crack open. "What in hell are you doing? I'm ordering you to get back in the air immediately." Zolar's words froze in his throat as he found himself staring down the muzzle of a gun pointed between his eyes. The pilot was still seated in his seat, as were the co-pilot and flight engineer. Henry Moore stood in the doorway, gripping a strange 9mm automatic of his own design. While inside the cockpit, Mickey Moore was talking over the aircraft radio as she calmly aimed a Lilliputian 25-caliber automatic at the pilot's neck. "Forgive the unscheduled stop, my former friends," said Moore in a commanding voice neither Zolar nor Oxley had heard before. "But, as you can see, there's been a change of plan." Zolar squinted down the gun barrel, and his face twisted from shock to menacing anger. "You idiot! You blind idiot! Do you have any idea what you've done?" "Why, yes," Moore answered matter-of-factly. "Mickey and I have hijacked your aircraft and its cargo of golden artifacts. I believe you're aware of the old maxim, there is no honor among thieves." "If you don't get this plane in the air quickly," Oxley pleaded, "customs agents will be swarming all over it." "Now that you mention it, Mickey and I did entertain the idea of turning the artifacts over to the authorities." "You can't know what you're saying." "Oh, I most certainly do, Charlie, old pal. As it turns out, federal agents are more interested in you and your brother than Huascar's treasure." Where did you come from? Zolar demanded. We merely caught a ride in one of the helicopters transporting the gold. The army engineers were used to our presence and paid no attention as we climbed aboard the plane. We hid out in one of the restrooms until the pilot left to confer with you and Charles on the airstrip. Then we seized the cockpit. Why would federal agents take your word for anything? Asked Oxley. In a manner of speaking, Mickey and I were once agents ourselves, Moore briefly explained. After we took over the cockpit, Mickey radioed some old friends in Washington who arranged your reception. Zolar looked as if he were about to tear Moore's lungs out, whether he got shot in the attempt or not. You and your lying wife made a deal for a share of the antiquities, am I right? He waited for a reply, but when Moore remained silent, he went on. What percentage did they offer you? 10? 20? Maybe as high as 50%? We made no deals with the government, Moore said slowly. We knew you had no intention of honoring our agreement, and that you planned to kill us. We had planned to steal the treasure for ourselves, but as you can see, we had a change of heart. The way they act familiar with guns, said Oxley. Cyrus was right. They are a pair of killers. Moore nodded in agreement. Your brother has an inner eye. It takes an assassin to know one. A pounding came from outside the forward passenger door on the deck below. Moore gestured down the stairwell with his gun. Go down and open it, he ordered Zolar and Oxley. A pounding came from outside the forward passenger door on the deck below. Moore gestured down the stairwell with his gun. Go down and open it, he ordered Zolar and Oxley. Sullenly, they did as they were told. When the pressurized door was swung open, two men entered from a stairway that had been pushed up against the aircraft. Both wore business suits. One was a huge black man who looked as if he might have played professional football. The other was a nattily dressed white man. Zolar immediately sensed they were federal agents. Joseph Zolar and Charles Oxley, I am Agent David Gaskell with the Customs Service, and this is Agent Francis Ragsdale of the FBI. You gentlemen are under arrest for smuggling illegal artifacts into the United States and for the theft of countless art objects from private and public museums, not excluding the unlawful forgery and sale of antiquities. What are you talking about? Zolar demanded. Gaskell ignored him and looked at Ragsdale with a big toothy smile. Would you like to do the honors? Ragsdale nodded like a kid who had just been given a new disc player. Yes, indeed, thank you. As Gaskell cuffed Zolar and Oxley, Ragsdale read them their rights. You made good time, said Moore. We were told you were in Calexico. We were on our way aboard a military jet 15 minutes after word came down from FBI headquarters in Washington, replied Ragsdale. Oxley looked at Gaskell, a look for the first time empty of fear and shock, a sudden look of shrewdness. You'll never find enough evidence to convict us in 100 years. Ragsdale tilted his head toward the golden cargo. What do you call that? We're merely passengers, said Zolar, regaining his composure. We were invited along for the ride by Professor Moore and his wife. I see. And suppose you tell me where all the stolen art and antiquities in your facility in Galveston came from. Oxley sneered. Our Galveston warehouse is perfectly legitimate. You've raided it before and never found a thing. If that's the case, said Ragsdale craftily, how do you explain the tunnel leading from the Logan Storage Company to Zolar International's subterranean warehouse of stolen goods? The brothers stared at each other, their faces abruptly gray. You're making this up, said Zolar fearfully. Am I? Would you like me to describe your tunnel in detail and provide a brief rundown on the stolen masterworks we found? The tunnel. You couldn't have found the tunnel. As of 36 hours ago, said Gaskell, Xolar International and your clandestine operation known as Sope Machaco are permanently out of business. Ragsdale added, A pity your dad, Mansfield Xolar, a.k.a. the Spectre, isn't still alive, or we could bust him too. Xolar looked as if he were in the throes of cardiac arrest. Oxley appeared too paralyzed to move. By the time you two and the rest of your family, partners, associates, and buyers get out of prison, you'll be as old as the artifacts you stole. Federal agents began filling the aircraft. The FBI took charge of the aircrew and Xolar's serving lady, while the customs people unbuckled the tie-down straps securing the golden artifacts. Ragsdale nodded to his team. Take them downtown to the U.S. Attorney's Office. As soon as the shattered and thoroughly broken art thieves were led into two different cars, the agents turned to the Moors. I can't tell you how grateful we are for your cooperation, said Gaskell. Nailing the Xolar family will put a huge dent in the art theft and artifact smuggling trade. We are not entirely benevolent, said Mickey, happily relieved. Henry feels certain the Peruvian government will post a reward. Gaskell nodded. I think you've got a sure bet. The prestige of being the first to catalog and photograph the treasure will go a long way toward enhancing our scientific reputations, Henry Moore explained as he holstered his gun. Customs would also like a detailed report on the objects, if you don't mind, asked Gaskell. Moore nodded vigorously. Mickey and I will be happy to work with you. We've already inventoried the treasure. We'll have a report for you before it's formally returned to Peru. Where will you store it all until then? Asked Mickey. In a government warehouse whose location we can't reveal, answered Gaskell. Is there any news on Congresswoman Smith and the little man with Numa? Gaskell nodded. Minutes before you landed, we received word they were rescued by a local tribe of Indians and are on their way to a local hospital. Mickey sank down into a passenger seat and sighed. Then it's over. Henry sat on an armrest and took her hand in his. It is for us, he said gently. From now on, we'll live the rest of our lives together as a pair of old teachers in a university with vine-covered walls. She looked up at him. Is that so terrible? No, he said, kissing her lightly on the forehead. I think we can handle it.